And good afternoon, it's Rod McClure here with our Monday afternoon book reading. We've been reading Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott. And, well, we're reaching a very, very interesting point. We'll do a little recap, but before we do, a word from some very important people.
Capital Chemist Braidwood is open Monday to Friday 8am till 5pm and Saturday 8am to 12:30pm at their new larger premises at the Village Terrace. The friendly professional staff can assist you with medication packing to assist with managing your medication, having your scripts kept on file with the pharmacy, acquiring MedAdvisor, an online app to help order and manage your scripts that are on file, COVID-19 vaccinations. Capital Chemist Braidwood, proudly sponsoring Braidwood FM 88.9.
Our sponsor, Hockey's Braidwood, can supply you with sand, gravel, soil, road-based supplies or drinking water. They now have their tilt tray in operation and it has the capability to carry 20-foot shipping containers and anything around 12.5 tonne. Hockey's Braidwood can be contacted on 4842 2286 or by phoning Stephen Hockey on 0429 422 286. Ever thought of becoming a Freemason? Freemasonry is made up of men from all walks of life, serving their community while engaged in self-improvement, building friendships and seeking excellence in all pursuits. Lodge of Truth Braidwood has been in our community for over 160 years and we invite you to become a member of Braidwood's longest serving fraternity. If this interests you, please call Phil Schumark on 0427 422 046 for more information about membership. Sponsoring Braidwood FM 88.9.
And thank you to all of those local sponsors of our radio station. Well, we've been reading Ivanhoe, as I said, and we've reached the point where the castle of Front du Bœuf has been stormed, and we have a situation where de Bracy has basically been taken prisoner, and of course Rebecca has been taken by the Templar. And we're at the point where the Prior of Jorvaulx has been given a bit of a choice. And of course, Isaac doesn't like parting with money, does he? But nonetheless, he's been forced to do so. It remained that the Jew should produce some security for the ransom which he was to pay on the Prior's account, as well as the ransom, as upon his own. He gave accordingly an order sealed with his signet to a brother of his tribe at York, requiring him to pay the bearer the sum of 1,000 crowns, and to deliver certain merchandises specified in the note. "My brother Shiva," he said, groaning deeply, "has the key of my warehouses."
"And of the vaulted chamber?" whispered Locksley.
"No, no, may heaven forfend," said Isaac. "Evil is the hour that let anyone whomsoever into that secret." "It is safe with me," said the outlaw. "So be that this scroll produce the sum therein nominated and set down. But what now, Isaac? Art dead? Art stupefied? Hath payment of 1,000 crowns put your daughter's peril out of your mind?" The Jew started to his feet. "No, Dickon, no. I will presently set forth. Farewell, you whom I may not call good and dare not and will not call evil." Yet ere Isaac departed, the outlaw chief bestowed on him this parting advice. "Be liberal in your offers, Isaac, and spare not your purse for your daughter's safety. Credit me that the gold you will spare in her cause will hereafter give you as much agony as if it were poured molten down your throat." Isaac acquiesced with a deep groan, and set forth on his journey, accompanied by two tall foresters, who were to be his guides and at the same time his guards through the wood. The Black Knight, who had seen with no small interest these various proceedings, now took his leave of the outlaw in turn, nor could he avoid expressing his surprise at having witnessed so much civil policy amongst persons cast out from all ordinary protection and influence of the laws. "Good fruit, Sir Knight," said the yeoman, "will sometimes grow on a sorry tree, and evil times are not always productive of evil, alone and unmixed. Amongst those who are drawn into this lawless state, there are, doubtless, numbers who wish to exercise its license with some moderation, and some who regret, it may be, that they are obliged to follow such a trade at all." "And one of those," said the knight, "I am now, I presume, speaking?"
Sir Knight, said the outlaw, we have each our secret. You are welcome to form your judgment of me, and I may use my conjectures touching you, though neither of our shafts may hit the mark they are shot at. But as I do not pray to be admitted into your mystery, be not offended that I preserve my own.
I crave pardon, brave outlaw, said the knight. Your reproof is just, but it may be we shall meet hereafter with less of concealment on either side. Meanwhile, we part as friends, do we not?
There is my hand upon it, said Locksley, and I will call it the hand of a true Englishman, though an outlaw for the present. And there is mine in return, said the knight, and I hold it honoured to by being clasped with yours. For he that does good, having the unlimited power to do evil, deserves praise not only for the good he performs, but for the evil that he forbears. Fare you well, gallant outlaw. And so parted that fair friendship, and he of the fetterlock, mounting upon his strong war horse, rode off through the forest.
Chapter 34.
There was brave feasting in the castle of York, to which Prince John had invited those nobles, prelates, and leaders by whose assistance he hoped to carry through his ambitious projects upon his brother's throne. Waldemere Fitzurse, his able and politic agent, was at secret work among them, tempering all to that pitch of courage which was necessary in making an open declaration of their purpose. But their enterprise was delayed by the absence of more than one main limb of the Confederacy. The stubborn and daring, though brutal, courage of Front de Boeuf, the buoyant spirits and bold bearing of De Bracy, the sagacity, martial experience, and renowned valour of Brian de Bois Guilbert were important to the success of their conspiracy, and while cursing in secret their unnecessary and unmeaning absence, neither John nor his adviser dared to proceed without them. Isaac the Jew also seemed to have vanished, and with him the hope of certain sums of money, making up the subsidy for which Prince John had contracted with the Israelite and his brethren. This deficiency was likely to prove perilous in an emergency so critical. It was on the morning after the fall of Torquilston that a confused report began to spread abroad in the city of York that De Bracy and Bois de Guilbert, with their confederate Front de Boeuf, had been taken or slain. Waldemere brought the rumour to Prince John, announcing that he feared its truth the more that they had set out with small attendants for the purpose of committing an assault on the Saxon Cedric and his attendants. At another time the prince would have treated this deed of violence as a good jest, but now that it interfered with and impeded his own plans, he exclaimed against the perpetrators and spoke of the broken laws and the infringement of public order and of private property in a tone which might have become King Alfred.
"The unprincipled marauders," he said. "Were I ever to become monarch of England, I would hang such transgressors over the drawbridges of their own castles."
But to become monarch of England, said his Ahitophel coolly, it is necessary not only that your grace should endure the transgressions of these unprincipled marauders, but that you should afford them your protection, notwithstanding your laudable zeal for the laws they are in the habit of infringing. We shall be finely helped if the churl Saxons should have realised your grace's vision of converting feudal drawbridges into gibbets, and yonder bold-spirited Cedric seems one to whom such an imagination just might occur. Your grace is well aware it will be dangerous to stir without Front de Boeuf, De Bracy, and the Templar, and yet we have gone too far to recede with safety." Prince John struck his forehead with impatience, and then began to stride up and down the apartment. "The villains," he said, "the base, treacherous villains, to desert me at this pinch. No, say rather the feather-pated, giddy madman," said Waldemere, "who must be toying with follies when such business was at hand."
"What is to be done?"
said the prince, stopping short before Waldemar. "I know nothing which can be done," answered his counsellor, "save that which I have already taken order for. I come not to bewail this evil chance with your grace until I had done my best to remedy it." "You were ever my better angel, Waldemere," said the prince, "and when I have such a chancellor to advise withal, the reign of John will be renowned in our annals. What have you commanded?"
"I have ordered Lewis Winkelbrand, De Bracy's lieutenant,
to cause his trumpet sound to horse, and to display his banner, and to set presently forth towards the castle of Front de Boeuf, to do what yet may be done for the succour of our friends." Prince John's face flushed with the pride of a spoilt child, who has undergone what it conceives to be an insult. "By the face of God," he said, "Waldemere Fitzurse, much have you taken upon yourself. And over Malapert you were to cause a trumpet to blow or a banner to be raised in a town where ourselves were in presence without our express command?" "I crave your grace's pardon," said Fitzurse, internally cursing the idle vanity of his patron. "But when time pressed, and even the loss of minutes might be fatal, I judged it best to take this much burden upon me in a manner of such importance to your grace's interest." "You are pardoned," Fitzurse said the prince gravely. "Your purpose has atoned for your hasty rashness. But whom have we here? Ah, De Bracy himself, by the rood. And in strange guise does he come before us." It was indeed De Bracy. Bloody with spurring, fiery red with speed, his armour bore all the marks of the late obstinate fray, being broken, defaced and stained, with blood in many places, and covered with clay and dust from the crest to the spur. Undoing his helmet, he placed it on the table and stood a moment, as if to collect himself before he told his news. "De Bracy," said Prince John, "what means this? Speak, I demand it of you. Are the Saxons in rebellion?" "Speak, De Bracy," said Fitzurse, almost in the same moment with his master. "You were wont to be a man. Where is the Templar? Where is Front de Boeuf?" "The Templar is fled," said De Bracy. "Front de Boeuf you will never see more. He has found a red grave among the blazing rafters of his own castle, and I alone am escaped to tell you." "Cold news," said Waldemere, "to us, though you speak of fire and conflagration." "The worst news is not yet said," answered De Bracy, and coming up to Prince John, he uttered, in a low and emphatic tone, "Richard is in England. I have seen and spoken with him." Prince John turned pale, tottered, and caught at the back of an oaken bench to support himself, but much like a man who receives an arrow in his chest. You rave, De Bracy," said Fitzurse. "It cannot be." "It is as true as truth itself," said De Bracy. "I was his prisoner, and I spoke with him."
"With Richard Plantagenet, you say?" continued Fitzurse.
"With Richard Plantagenet," replied De Bracy. "With Richard Coeur de Lion. With Richard of England. Richard the Lionheart."
"And you were his prisoner?" said Waldemere.
"He is then at the head of a power?"
"No. Only a few outlawed men were around him, and to these his person is unknown. I heard him say he was about to depart from them. He joined them only to assist at the storming of Torquilston."
"Aye," said Fitzurse, "such is indeed the fashion of Richard. A true knight errant he, and will wander in wild adventure, trusting the prowess of his single arm, like any Sir Guy or Sir Bevis, while the weighty affairs of his kingdom slumber and his own safety is endangered. What do you propose to do, De Bracy?"
I offered Richard the service of my free lancers, and he refused them. I will lead them to Hull, seize on shipping, and embark for Flanders. Thanks to the bustling times, a man of action will always find employment. And you, Waldemere, will you take lance and shield and lay down your policies and wend along with me and share the fate which God sends us?"
"I am too old, Maurice, and I have a daughter," answered Waldemere.
"Give her to me, Fitzurse, and I will maintain her as fits her rank with the help of lance and stirrup," said De Bracy.
"Not so," answered Fitzurse. "I will take sanctuary in this church of St. Peter. The Archbishop is my sworn brother." During this discourse, Prince John had gradually awakened from the stupor into which he had been thrown by the unexpected intelligence, and had been attentive to the conversation which passed between his followers. "They fall off from me," he said to himself. "They hold no more by me than a withered leaf by the bough when the breeze blows on it.
hell and fiends, can I shape no means for myself when I am deserted by these cravens?" He paused, and there was an expression of diabolical passion in the constrained laugh which he at length broke in on their conversation.
"My good lords, by the light of Our Lady's brow, I held you sage men, bold men, ready-witted men. Yet you throw down wealth on a pleasure, all that our noble game promised you at the moment it might be won by one bold cast."
"I understand you not," said De Bracy. "As soon as Richard's return is blown abroad, he will be at the head of an army, and all is then over with us. I would counsel you, my lord, either fly to France or take the protection of the Queen Mother."
"I seek no safety for myself," said Prince John haughtily,
"that I could secure by a word spoken to my brother. But although you, De Bracy, and you, Waldemar of Fitzurse, are so ready to abandon me, I should not greatly delight to see your heads blackening on Clifford's gate yonder. Think you, Waldemar, that the wily archbishop will not suffer you to be taken from the very horns of the altar? Would it make his peace with King Richard? And forget you, De Bracy, that Robert Estoffville lies between you and Hull with all his forces, and that the Earl of Essex is gathering his followers? If we had reason to fear these levies even before Richard's return, think you now there is any doubt which party their leaders will take? Oh, trust me, Estoteville alone has strength enough to drive all your freelancers into the Humber." Waldemar Fitzurse and De Bracy looked at each other's faces with blank dismay. "There is but one road to safety," continued the prince, and his brow grew black as midnight. "This object of our terror journeys alone. He must be met withal."
"Not by me," said De Bracy.
"I was his prisoner, and he took me to mercy. I will not harm a feather in his crest."
"Who spoke of harming him?" said Prince John, with a hardened laugh. "The knave will say next that I meant you should slay him."
"Oh, no, a prison were better. And whether in Britain or Austria, what matters it? Things will be but as they were when we commenced our enterprise. It was founded on the hope that Richard would remain a captive in Germany. Our uncle Robert lived and died in the castle of Cardiff."
"Aye, but," said Waldemar, your sire Henry sat more firm in his seat than your grace can. I say the best prison is that which is made by the sexton. No dungeon like a church vault. Ah, there, I've had my say."
"Prison or tomb," said De Bracy, "I wash my hands of the whole matter."
"Villain," said Prince John, "you wouldst not betray our counsel?"
"Counsel was never betrayed by me," said De Bracy haughtily, "nor must the name of villain be coupled with mine."
"Peace, Sir Knight," said Waldemar.
"Are you good, my lord? Forgive the scruples of the valiant De Bracy. I trust I shall soon remove them."
"That passes your eloquence, Fitzurse," replied the knight.
"Why, good Sir Maurice," rejoined the wily politician, "start not aside like a scared steed without at least considering the object of your terror, this Richard. But a day since, and it would have been your dearest wish to have met him hand to hand in the ranks of battle. 100 times I've heard you wish it."
"Aye," said De Bracy, "but that was, as you say, hand to hand and in the ranks of battle. You never heard me breathe a thought of assaulting him alone and in a forest."
"You are no good knight if you do scruple at it," said Waldemar. "Was it in battle that Lancelot, De Lac, and Sir Tristram won renown? Or was it not by encountering gigantic knights under the shade of deep and unknown forests?"
"Aye, but I promise you," said De Bracy, "that neither Tristram nor Lancelot would have been match hand to hand for Richard Plantagenet, and I think it was not their wont to take odds against a single man."
"You are mad, De Bracy. What is it we propose to you? A hired and retained captain of free companions, whose swords are purchased for Prince John's service. You are apprised of our enemy, and then you scruple, though your patron's fortunes, those of your comrades, your own, and the life and honour of every one amongst us, are
at stake. I tell you, said De Bracy sullenly, that he gave me my life. True. He sent me from his presence and refused my homage. So far, I owe him neither favour nor allegiance, but I will not lift a hand against him. It needs not. Send Lewis Winkelbrand and a score of your lancers. You have sufficient ruffians of your own, said De Bracy. Not one of mine shall budge on such an errand. Are you so obstinate, De Bracy? Said Prince John. And will you forsake me after so many protestations of zeal for my service? I mean it not, said De Bracy. I will abide by you in aught that becomes a knight, whether in the lists or in the camp, but this highway practice comes not within my vow. Come hither, Waldemere, said Prince John. An unhappy prince am I. My father, King Henry, had faithful servants. He had but to say that he was plagued with a factious priest, and the blood of Thomas a Becket, saint though he was, stained the steps of his own altar. Tracy, Morville, Brito, loyal and daring subjects, your names, your spirit are extinct, and although Reginald Fitzurse has left a son, he has fallen off from his father's fidelity and courage. He has fallen off from neither, said Waldemere Fitzurse, and since it may not better be, I will take on me the conduct of this perilous enterprise. Dearly, however, did my father purchase the praise of a zealous friend, and yet did his proof of loyalty to Henry fall far short of what I am about to afford. For rather would I assail a whole calendar of saints than put spear in rest against Coeur de Lion. De Bracy, to you I must trust to keep up the spirits of the doubtful and to guard Prince John's person. If you receive such news as I trust to send you, our enterprise will no longer wear a doubtful aspect. Page, he said, get to my lodgings. Tell my armourer to be there in readiness, and bid Stephen Wetherall, Broad Thorsby, and the three spears of Spyinghow come to me instantly, and let the scoutmaster Hugh Barden attend me also. Adieu, my prince, till better times. Thus speaking, he left the apartment. He goes to make my brother prisoner, said Prince John to De Bracy, with as little touch of compunction as if it but concerned the liberty of a Saxon franklin. I trust he will observe our orders and use our dear Richard's person with all due respect. De Bracy only answered by a smile. By the light of Our Lady's brow, said Prince John, our orders to him were most precise, though it may be you heard them not as we stood together in the oriel window. Most clear and positive was our charge that Richard's safety should be cared for, and woe to Waldemere's head if he transgress it. I had better pass his lodgings, said De Bracy, and make him fully aware of your grace's pleasure, for as it quite escaped my ear, it may not perchance have reached that of Waldemere. Oh, no, no, said Prince John impatiently. I promise you he heard me, and besides, I have further occupation for you, Maurice. Come hither. Let me lean on your shoulder. They walked a turn through the hall in this familiar posture, and Prince John, with an air of the most confidential intimacy, proceeded to say, what think you of this, Waldemere Fitzurse, my De Bracy? He trusts to be our Chancellor. Surely he will pause ere we give an office so high to one who shows evidently how little he reverences our blood by his so readily undertaking this enterprise against Richard. You do think, I warrant, that you have lost somewhat of our regard by boldly declining this unpleasing task, but no, Maurice, I rather honour you for your virtuous constancy. There are things most necessary to be done, the perpetrator of which we neither love nor honour, and there may be refusals to service, which shall rather exalt in our estimation those who deny our request. The arrest of my unfortunate brother forms no such good title to the high office of Chancellor as your chivalrous and courageous denial establishes in you to the truncheon of High Marshal. Think of this, De Bracy, and begone to your charge. Fickle tyrant, muttered De Bracy as he left the presence of the prince. Evil luck have they who trust you. Your Chancellor, indeed. He who has the keeping of your conscience shall have an easy charge, I believe. but High Marshal of England. That, he said, extending his arm as if to grasp the baton of office and assuming a loftier stride along the antechamber, that is indeed a prize worth playing for.
De Bracy had no sooner left the apartment than Prince John summoned an attendant. "I bid Hugh Bardon, our scoutmaster, come hither, as soon as he shall have spoken with Waldemar Fitzurse." The scoutmaster arrived after a brief delay, during which John traversed the apartment with unequal and disordered steps.
"Bardon," said he, "what did Waldemar desire of you?"
"Two resolute men, well acquainted with these northern wilds, and skilful in tracking the tread of man and horse. And you have fitted him?" "Let your grace never trust me else," answered the master of the spies. "One is from Hexhamshire. He is wont to trace the Tynedale and Teviotdale thieves as a bloodhound follows the slot of a hurt deer. The other is Yorkshire bred, and he has twanged his bowstring right oft in merry Sherwood. He knows each glade and dingle, copse and highwood, between this and Richmond."
"'Tis well," said the prince. "Goes Waldemar forth with them?"
"Instantly," said Bardon.
"With what attendance?"
"Broad Thoresby goes with him, and Wetherill, whom they call for his cruelty Stephen Steelheart, and three northern men-at-arms that belong to Ralph Middleton's gang. They are called the Spears of Spyinghow."
"'Tis well," said Prince John, then added after a moment's pause, "Bardon, it imports our service that you keep a strict watch upon Maurice de Bracy, so that he shall not observe it. However, and let us know of his motions from time to time, with whom he converses, what he proposeth. Fail not in this, as you will be answerable."
Hugh Bardon bowed and retired.
"If Maurice betrays me," said Prince John, "if he betrays me as his bearing leads me to fear, I will have his head, were Richard thundering at the gates of York."
Chapter 35. Our tale now returns to Isaac of York, mounted upon a mule, the gift of the outlaw, with two tall yeomen to act as his guard and guides. The Jew had set out for the preceptory of Templestowe, for the purpose of negotiating his daughter's redemption. The preceptory was but a day's journey from the demolished castle of Torkelston, and the Jew had hoped to reach it before nightfall. Accordingly, having dismissed his guides at the verge of the forest, and rewarded them with a piece of silver, he began to press on with such speed as his weariness permitted him to exert, but his strength failed him totally before he had reached within 4 miles of the temple court. Racking pains shot along his back and through his limbs, and the excessive anguish which he felt at heart being now augmented by bodily suffering, he was rendered altogether incapable of proceeding further than the small market town, where dwelt a Jewish rabbi of his tribe, eminent in the medical profession, and to whom Isaac was well known. Nathan ben Israel received his suffering countryman with that kindness which the law prescribed and which the Jews practised to each other. He insisted on his betaking himself to repose and used such remedies as were then in most repute to check the progress of the fever, which terror, fatigue, ill usage, and sorrow had brought upon the poor old Jew. On the morrow, when Isaac proposed to rise and pursue his journey, Nathan remonstrated against his purpose, both as his host and as his physician. It might cost him, he said, his life. But Isaac replied that more than life and death depended upon his going that morning to Templestowe. "To Templestowe?" said his host with surprise, again felt his pulse and then muttered to himself. "His fever is abated, yet it seems his mind is somewhat alienated and disturbed." "And why not to Templestowe?" answered his patient. "I grant you, Nathan, that it is a dwelling of those whom the despised children of the promise are a stumbling block and an abomination, yet you know that pressing affairs of traffic sometimes carry us among these bloodthirsty Nazarene soldiers, and that we visit the preceptories of the Templars as well as the commanderies of the Knights Hospitallers, as they are called." "I know it well," said Nathan. "But what you that Lucas de Beaumoisnard, the chief of their order, and whom they term Grand Master, is now himself at Templestowe?"
"I know it not," said Isaac. "Our last letters from our brethren at Paris advised us that he was at that city, beseeching Philip for aid against the Sultan, Salah ad-Din. "He has since come to England, unexpected by his brethren," said Ben Israel, "and he comes among them with a strong and outstretched arm to correct and to punish. His countenance is kindled in anger against those who have departed from the bow which they have made, and great is the fear of these sons of Belial. You must have heard of this man." "It is well known to me," said Isaac, "that Gentiles deliver this Lucas Beaumanoir as a man zealous to slaying for every point of the Nazarene law, and our brethren have termed him a fierce destroyer of the Saracens and a cruel tyrant to the children of the promise." "And truly have they termed him," said Nathan the physician. "Other Templars may be moved from the purpose of their heart by pleasure, or bribed by promise of gold and silver, but Beaumanoir is a different stamp, hating sensuality, despising treasure, and pressing forward to that which they call the crown of martyrdom. The God of Jacob speedily send it unto him and unto them all. Especially has this proud man extended his glove over the children of Judah, as holy David over Edom, holding the murder of a Jew to be an offering of as sweet savour as the death of a Saracen. Impious and false things, has he said, even of the virtues of our medicines, as if they were the devices of Satan. The Lord rebuke him." "Nevertheless," said Isaac, "I must present myself at Templestowe, although he has made his face like unto a fiery furnace seven times heated." He then explained to Nathan the pressing cause of his journey. The rabbi listened with interest and testified his sympathy after the fashion of his people, rending his clothes and saying, "Ah, my daughter, ah, my daughter, alas for the beauty of Zion, alas for the captivity of Israel." "You see," said Isaac, "how it stands with me, and that I may not tarry. Peradventure the presence of this Lucas Beaumanoir, being the chief man over them, may turn Brian de Bois-Guilbert from the ill which he does meditate, and that he may deliver to me my beloved daughter Rebecca." "Go you," said Nathan ben Israel, "and be wise, for wisdom availed Daniel in the den of lions into which he was cast, and may it go well with you, even as your heart wishes. Yet if you can keep yourself from the presence of the Grand Master, for to do foul scorn to our people is his morning and evening delight, it may be if you could speak with Bois-Guilbert in private, you shall have the better prevail with him, for men say that these accursed Nazarenes are not one of one mind in the preceptory. May their counsels be confounded and brought to shame. But do you, brother, return to me as if it were to the house of your father, and bring me word how it has sped with you. And well do I hope you will bring with you Rebecca, ever the scholar of the wise Miriam, and whose cures the Gentiles slandered as if they had been wrought by necromancy." Isaac accordingly bade his friend farewell, and about an hour's riding brought him before the preceptory of the Templestowe. This establishment of the Templars was seated amidst fair meadows and pastures. With the devotion of the former preceptor, he had bestowed this upon their order. It was strong and well fortified, a point never neglected by these knights, and which the disordered state of England rendered peculiarly necessary. Two halberdiers clad in black guarded the drawbridge, and others in the same sad livery glided to and fro upon the wall with a funeral pace, resembling spectres more than soldiers. The inferior officers of the order were thus dressed ever since their use of white garments, similar to those of the knights and squires, had given rise to a combination of certain false brethren in the mountains of Palestine, terming themselves Templars and bringing great dishonour on the order. A knight was now and then seen to cross the court in his long white cloak, his head depressed, on his breast, and his arms folded. They passed each other, if they chanced to meet, with a slow, solemn, and mute greeting, for such was the rule of their order, quoting thereupon the holy texts, "In many words you shall not avoid sin, and life and death are in the power of the tongue." In a word, the stern ascetic rigour of temple discipline which had so long been exchanged for prodigal and licentious indulgence, seemed at once to have revived at Templestowe under the severe eye of Lucas Beaumanoir. Isaac paused at the gate to consider how he might seek entrance in the manner most likely to bespeak favour, for he was well aware that to his unhappy race the reviving fanaticism of the order was not less dangerous than their unprincipled licentiousness, and that his religion would be the object of hate and persecution in the one case, as his wealth would have exposed him in the other to the extortions of unrelenting oppression. Meantime, Lucas Beaumanoir walked in a small garden belonging to the preceptory, included within the precincts of its exterior fortification, and held sad and confidential communication with a brother of his order who had come in his company from Palestine. The Grand Master was a man advanced in age, as was testified by his long grey beard and the shaggy grey eyebrows overhanging his eyes, of which, however, years had been unable to quench the fire. A formidable warrior, his thin and severe features retained the soldier's fierceness of expression. An ascetic bigot, they were no less marked by the emaciation of abstinence and the spiritual pride of the self-satisfied devotee. Yet with these severer traits of physiognomy, there were mixed somewhat a striking and noble, arising doubtless from the great part which his high office called upon him to act among monarchs and princes, and from the habitual exercise of supreme authority over the valiant and high-born knights who were united by the rules of the order. His stature was tall, and his gait undepressed by age and toil. It was erect and stately. His white mantle was shaped with severe regularity, according to the rule of St. Bernard himself, being composed of what was then called burrow cloth, exactly fitted to the size of the wearer, and bearing on the left shoulder the octangular cross peculiar to the order, formed of red cloth. No veil or ermine decked this garment, but in respect to his age, the Grand Master, as permitted by the rules, wore his doublet lined and trimmed with the softest lambskin, dressed with the wool outwards, which was the nearest approach he could regularly make to the use of fur, then the greatest luxury of dress. In his hand he bore that singular abacus, or staff of office, which the Templars are usually represented, having at the upper end a round plate on which was engraved the cross of the order, inscribed within a circle or awl, as the heralds term it. His companion, who attended on this great personage, had nearly the same dress in all respects, but his extreme deference towards his superior showed that no other quality subsisted between them. The preceptor, for such he was in rank, walked not in a line with the Grand Master, but just so far behind that Beaumanoir could speak to him without turning around his head. Well, the Grand Master appears to be an ascetic, a bigot, and cruel. On the other hand, he's cleaning up the Templars who they've been bad boys in Britain, let's face it. And it does bring them in the end to a very, very bad end, not so much within the book, but in reality. Nonetheless, we'll read more of Ivanhoe next week, Monday afternoon, 4:05. I look forward to being with you. Until then, keep safe, keep warm.